The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. We are the very first global fintech podcast and radio show. We're in 72 countries and getting on close to 2 million listeners that listen to Breaking Banks. So you guys are awesome. Thank you for the awesome support. Now, this is the second installment of our five-week series, and we're going to exploring a lot of different elements of the blockchain and why this is so hot right now. But at this point, it's my pleasure to welcome back to co-host this series with me, Chris Skinner, who's a well-known thought leader in the fintech space. He's the blogger and the chair of the Financial Services Club and the author of Value Web, which has just entered its second printing. Chris Skinner, welcome back as my co-host.
Hey, Brett, I've renamed your show Breaking Blocks. Let's do it.
Oh, that's a good idea. We can be breaking blocks this month. Yeah, but it goes back to breaking banks later. So, I want to get to some of the news in a moment. But before we go any further, a quick shout out to our special sponsor for the blockchain series, Edge Labs. Edge Labs are specialists in new and emerging technologies, including blockchain, smart contracts, and AI machine learning. They're a key sponsor for this five-episode arc on the blockchain. You can check them out at edgelabs.io. A few conference announcements before we get to the news. We have Finovate 4 coming up in September 8th and 9th. In New York City. My startup Movin is going to be there. It's the premier conference in fintech. You can register for Finovate New York using the Breaking Banks 20 discount code, and you get a 20% discount off. But the day before Finovate Fall in New York City, on September 7th, JP Nichols, Dave Birch, also some hosts and regulars on Breaking Banks, and I will be at Next Money New York City. Are you going to be there, Chris? You're not going to be at that one, right?
No, I'm going to miss that one, I'm afraid.
You'll be flying
all over and trying to stay at home as much as possible.
Absolutely. And so you can get a discount for Next Money as well. It's a 25% discount using the BB25 discount fee. And also don't forget FinDevor Silicon Valley coming up on October 18th and 19th. We have a discount code for that as well, BBanksDevR20, and you get a 20% discount. So, Chris, what do you think about this war that's going on between Apple Pay and the Australian banks at the moment?
It's funny. I mean, when it started, it seemed that it's going to fail because you've only got three of the big banks involved in the case. And to a large extent, you know, Apple, if they do a deal with just one bank, they're in, aren't they? And for competitive reasons, all the other banks will then be going, oh, geez, we better partner with them because they've got that one bank. So it was doomed to failure from the start, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, of course, a couple of the regulars on our show, Cherian Abraham and Brian Rommel, have come down on Apple's side on this front, and Cherian's calling BS on this. He says, you can read his piece on bankinnovation.net, Banks Down Under Declare War on Apple. So that's pretty good. Lending Club had their results out. What did you think about their results, Chris? They got $1.9 billion in new loans.
Well, you know, Lending Club's been stumbling in the last 12 months due to their founder being caught out doing some dealings that weren't appreciated, and equally then trying to sort of take the business out of their hands, I guess, when the share price tanked. So it's good to see that they are originating a loan portfolio, but at the same time, you know, that there's lots of challenges in the US lending markets, mainly because they're sourcing their funds primarily from institutions, which is not so good.
Yeah, well, they lost their CFO as well 2 days ago. Yeah. Did you see that?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a business that you know, like Prosper and Sophie and Funding Circle, you know, I like these business ideas, but we're still very early days in the fintech revolution. And, you know, what's going to happen eventually is you'll see one of these big lenders become a global platform marketplace. But right now, I don't think it's going to be Lending Club.
Yeah. Yeah, so true. And the other news, of course, coming out of the UK, Chris, is Mondo has finally got their banking license.
Yeah, we've got a whole wave of banks coming in the UK, and that there's something like 40 that are going through the accreditation process with the regulators. Starling got their license last week, Mondo this week. There's also been Tide and a number of others that have been announcing their presence. Quite a few that have been in Skunk Works that haven't even been visible.
Stealth mode.
Yeah, stealth, definitely. And they're all doing interesting things, but do we need 40 new banks when they're still dominated by five big ones that own 80% of the accounts in the UK? We'll see.
Mm, indeed. I'm a bit surprised that Jason Bates left Mondo just before they got their license. Can you give any insight to that?
Not a great deal. I mean, he's a co-founder of Mondo and still obviously has a stake in the business, but equally, I think, saw the interest in creating a new fintech consultancy, 11FS, with Simon and David Breer and a number of other people who have been on your show. So, you know, it's a time of being ripe for creating and advising and consulting on lots of new digital bank startups rather than just one, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. All right. So, well, let's jump straight into it. We have a special guest on the show today. Actually, we've got a bunch of special guests on the show today. So let's bring them on right now. First of all, I'd like to introduce Alex Tapscott. He's the author of the best-selling new book called Blockchain Revolution, and that's number one in banking today. He moved you out of the number one slot, Chris. How do you feel about that?
it happens. Suffice to say, they're both really good books.
Yeah, there you go. And he's the CEO and founder of Northwest Passages Ventures, an advisory firm who's building blockchain companies. And he wrote the seminal report on governing digital currencies for the Global Solutions Network program at the Joseph L. Rotman School of Management at University of Toronto. Alex Tapscott, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Delighted to be here.
So where are you calling in from?
Today I'm in Toronto, Canada. Home base.
Very good. Yeah. So you said the weather was nice and hot there today.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah, makes a change for the winter when it's brutal. That's why they've got all their shopping centers underground.
Yeah, we only live on the far extremes. It's either brutally cold or unbearably hot.
There's nothing in between.
We've lost spring and fall. They don't exist anymore in Canada.
Yeah, well, so we also have joining us on the show today, Jack Tata. He's the founder and owner of Gem Research Solutions, and he co-authored one of the first books on Bitcoin. What's the deal with Bitcoins? Jack, say hello to the audience at Breaking Banks.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. And then also we have Bailey joining us, Bailey Rutzel. Is that right? How I pronounce it, Bailey?
It's Reitzel, actually.
Reitzel, sorry.
Yeah, all right.
You're the writer of Money Tripping, and you grew up in the Midwest, but your work has appeared on CoinDesk, Quartz, American Banker, and a handful of other industry blogs. So you're in the process of starting, of course, a new podcast yourself on blockchain and all things happening in that space. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
No
hey,
problem.
Bailey.
Hey there.
Hey, so Chris, do you want to just sort of update us before we jump into blockchain revolution? Tell us what's happening on the blockchain trade finance side of things, because there's a lot of hot news in that respect.
Yeah, there's been a couple of major announcements this week from some of the banks, and it's really interesting that R3 announced Corda in April, which is the bank variant of blockchain technologies. It's actually a completely different platform that's specifically for counterparty financial institutions to create distributed ledgers. And that platform's been intriguing because nothing's been done with it, but an announcement came out this week saying, hey, there's 15 banks that have just been experimenting with using it for accounts receivables and ledgers of credit in trade finance. And you've got Commonwealth Bank of Australia, Barclays, BBVA, Danske, ING, you know, you've got Wells Fargo, you've got some of the biggest banks in the world
yeah.
doing some serious stuff. At the same time, there was another announcement that Bank of America and HSBC are using the Hyperledger protocol, which is what's behind Digital Assets Holdings, to create another trade finance letters of credit transaction process between banks, exporters, and importers at a live experiment. And then 6 months ago, you saw DBS and Standard Chartered Bank create a trade finance distributed ledger based on Ripple. Now, this is just really showing that the use case within financial services for trade finance, getting rid of letters of credit, bills of lading, and all that paper-based trail of stuff, is now being attacked by blockchain technologies in the same way that we saw clearing and settlement being attacked. And it'd just be interesting to see how that pans out, particularly as they're all using different blockchain protocol structures. And R3 Corda is probably the one that everyone's watching closest, because they've got, you know, over 40 of the biggest banks involved in their development. So I don't see why that wouldn't become the standard. But hey, Ripple and Hyperledger are also contenders.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so listen, that's something we can ask Alex as well. But Alex, I want to kick off with just a quote from the book and get your buy-in on this. You quote from a lot of leading thinkers in the space, including, you know, you talk about some Nobel laureates and you quote from Andreessen and so forth. And actually, I wanted to refer to one of the quotes from Andreessen in the book, which is, you know, you're quoting him, you're saying, they're like, oh my God, this is it. This is the big breakthrough. This is the thing we've been waiting for. And and that was in response to Satoshi Nakamoto's sort of posting of the blockchain and the Bitcoin protocols. And Andreessen proposed, according to your quote in the book, that whoever he is should get the Nobel Prize. He's a genius. So is that a sort of a good way to characterize the sort of excitement that we're seeing in blockchain today?
Yeah, I think that that quote perfectly captures it. I think there's a lot of rational exuberance for what this technology can mean. And we've become convinced basically that blockchain technology is the most important thing to happen in technology in a generation, and represents nothing short of the second generation of the internet. So when you use the internet today to send and move and share information, you're not actually sending an original. You're sending a copy, and you're retaining the original yourself. And generally speaking, that's okay for things like websites and PDFs and PowerPoints and emails. In fact, it's one of the sort of beautiful things about the internet, which is that we basically have a printing press for information. Except when it comes to things of value, like money or, say, securities, sending a copy is a really bad idea. If I can send the same $20 100 times, the $20 becomes worthless. If I can sell the same share in Apple 100 times, I've committed securities fraud. And so as a result, we have to rely on intermediaries. And these would be familiar to a lot of people, you know, banks, governments, big technology firms like Apple and Google, who sit in the middle of transactions and perform a whole bunch of important roles. The main one that they do is to establish the identity of parties in a transaction and to create trust. And then after that, they do all the clearing and the settling and the record keeping. But really, it's this question of establishing trust, because this double spend problem that I described had not been resolved throughout the first generation of the web. And unfortunately, intermediaries have got a few problems. For one, they're all centralized, and anything that's centralized is vulnerable to hacking or attack or to failure. We see this with regularity across basically every industry, JP Morgan, the State Department, LinkedIn, the Democratic Committee, etc. They cost a lot of money. You know, the average fees for sending a remittance payment, for example, is 10%. They exclude big parts of the population. There are 2.5 billion people in the world who don't have access to a bank account. They slow things down. I noticed before you were talking about trade finance. You know, I mean, like the time it takes to clear a transaction for, say, a letter of credit can be, you know, 30 or 40 days.
Don't even get me started on ACH in the U.S., dude. Don't even get me started.
I mean, ACH and SWIFT are technologies that are both 35 to 40 years old. And so it adds a lot of friction to the system. So you could basically argue in sum that they still capture a lot of the value, maybe even an asymmetric amount of the value, of the commerce that happens online, similar to how they did sort of in the pre-online era. So with blockchain, and this is why Andreessen and myself and others are so excited about this, with blockchain, you've got a second era of the internet where you have essentially a vast global ledger. It's kind of like a big spreadsheet that doesn't run on one bank server. It runs on every computer in the world. And it's not open to a few people, it's open to everyone. where not just information like emails and PDFs and websites and voice over IP, but literally anything of value. And that's where the real excitement is. So not just money and Bitcoin, but also stocks, bonds, letters of credit, titles and deeds, even votes in an election can be moved, stored, and managed securely and privately, and where trust is not established by an intermediary, but rather through a combination of cryptography, consensus, and clever code, as we say. So
I think what's interesting, Alex, is that I mean, you came from an investment bank, Canaccord Genuity, and it seems a lot of people from banking and the banking world got interested in this space first. Did you have to convince your father to write the book with you, or and equally, you created the blockchain practice for that firm, so you must have been getting into the nuts and bolts of this pretty early.
I'd say I was an early adopter, maybe not one of the first people to get into this. I started to get into Bitcoin. This is well before blockchain entered the vernacular as the sort of hot word in 2013. And, you know, to make a long story short, my dad and I over a big steak dinner and a bottle of wine decided to collaborate on a few projects looking into this. And that's where we started with the Bitcoin Governance Network, which is the paper you referred to earlier. And that led to a variety of other projects looking at blockchain's impact on financial services, on the corporation, on government, on the Internet of Things, on creative industries like music. And that became the basis for the book. So you're right that financial services folks were the first to, I'd say the first outside of the developer community to pick up on what this might mean for their business, but they're certainly not the last. And I think we're
the most excited, like you, because we can see this creating an internet of trust that gets rid of intermediaries that can mess up the process with corruption, and equally the internet of value, which is what I call value web. And those two pillars are, I think, critical parts of what you articulate in your book as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Chris, you're excited and I'm excited. Banks have
I'm
a slave.
I'm excited too, guys.
And Brett and everyone else. But banks have a little bit more nuance in how they're looking at this. And I think, broadly speaking, firms in the financial services industry kind of fall into three broad categories. So category one are the ones who are know that this is going to change their business, but don't really understand it, and so they're afraid. The second category, which is, I think, increasingly where a lot of FSIs are falling into, is that they're looking at this opportunistically as some kind of huge cost-saving measure. You know, the once-in-a-lifetime chance to reduce all of the friction and back-end costs from their own business logic. And it's a fascinating perspective, and it's one that's completely sensible from a bank's perspective. If you think about a bank today, you know, you've got increasing regulatory burden, you've got competition from fintech, you've got a slowing global economy. You know, revenue growth is probably going to be slow. So
just a quick aside on that one, Alex. The trade finance area, which I mentioned, is ripe for a lot of fraud. Standard Chartered wrote off $193 million, along with Citigroup and Standard Bank, from a Chinese company that gave them a Duff Metal deal last year. So that's the whole reason why they're getting into this space early.
Yeah, so that is, I mean, whether or not the cost is an operating cost or it's an ongoing cost like fraud, it's still a cost that they think that they can remove from their business. And I think that's totally valid, and I think that there are opportunities for banks to do that, except I'm not sure that that's the right general perspective to have. The right perspective to have is to be looking at this strategically. So I'm sure you guys saw Santander said banks could cut $20 billion of cost from the clearing and settling function for publicly listed equities, right? One specific vertical in the bank, huge cost-saving opportunity. Except the problem is you can't cut $20 billion of cost from a business that you don't control or own. And there's the potential that because we have, as you point out, this internet of value, internet of trust, that people will be able to transact and do business and trade in every kind of asset on a peer-to-peer basis, and where you don't necessarily need brokers and exchanges performing the same kinds of roles as intermediaries that you do today. So it's a bit myopic to say we're going to cut costs because there's a chance that you might be disrupted within that specific industry. So
the critical thing on what you just said, that Alex, is that obviously it's shared ledgers and it's therefore irrelevant if you're not sharing it.
Let me jump in there, right? Because we've had some issues with Bitfinex. We've had the hard fork of Ethereum recently. We've had these issues where you know, Bitcoins have been stolen and lost forever. We've got this debate between the Ethereum Classic and this new thing. The Ethereum Classic guys came out with their Declaration of Independence a couple of days ago. But the problem we've got is when these flaws are identified, you're talking about trust, that it's a more superior trust than centralization, but it's clear there's some flaws right now in the consensus model of the blockchain also. What's the way to fix it, Alex?
Well, it's important to distinguish between two problems there. The Bitfinex problem is an example of an intermediary getting hacked. So Bitfinex held information about users' private keys, and then that went missing when someone broke into their system. So it's actually indicative of the problems you have when intermediaries control too much information about users and their finances. The Ethereum issue is more nuanced, and I'm glad that you brought it up, which is, you know, and I'm not sure how familiar your listeners are, but there was this thing called the DAO, Distributed Autonomous Organization.
We've had David Orban on talking about the DAO, but we've got sort of two audience. We go out on the stream to the fintech professionals who would understand it, and then we've got the AM band here in New York. And so for those on the AM band that aren't familiar with it, the DAO was a distributed autonomous organization, or the first really artificial intelligence-based sort of self-managing corporation based on computer code. That's the simple explanation.
Yep, you got it. So, and then, of course, what happened was that the DAO was intended to raise money to make investments in the industry. Someone found a loophole in the what's called a smart contract, which is the programming technology that built the DAO, and they were able to exploit it. And so now we're left with this decision where, do you let the code be the law and move on and say what's done is done, or do you try and fix it? And what's happened is you've got a division within the community between those who think that if there's a problem, if everyone can reach consensus and fix it, they ought to fix it. And others who are saying, by going back and reversing a record which is supposed to be immutable, you're compromising the integrity of the technology. And that's what's led to this division. And I view that not so much as a problem with blockchain technology, but rather evidence of an absence of governance. And these kinds of open source communities don't really have the kind of governance that they need. And to be clear, when I say governance, I'm not talking about government, and I'm not talking about some corporation controlling, and I'm talking about stakeholders representing different parts of this community coming together to reach consensus on the best path forward. The internet has it, the Linux Foundation has it, Wikipedia has it, to date blockchain and Ethereum don't yet have it. And quite honestly, since I wrote my first paper advocating for governance of the community, not a ton has happened. And I think that's why you see these divisions within the community. But in no way is the hack of an exchange or a conflict between two camps of developers point to any flaw in the idea of distributed trust or an internet of value itself.
And I think it goes back to this. There's never going to be just one blockchain, Brett. There are multiple blockchains, and eventually end up with interoperability because you've got public blockchains, private blockchains. And I think what we're seeing with Ethereum and Bitcoin right now as public blockchains is that both communities say it's an experiment. It's not developed. It's not finished. So it's still going. It's still coming along. So, give it 5 years, we might see something else out there for all I know.
We have a couple of questions from the audience, Alex. One from our good pal Dave Birch in the UK, calling from where does he live, Chris? Do you remember?
Guildford, just outside
Guildford. Yeah. In Guildford. And he says, Alex, do you think that we should all look after our own private keys and not trust them to intermediaries?
The answer to that is it depends. I think that in order for blockchain to scale, there needs to be an ease of use factor. And the reality is, even the concept of a private key is far too alien for a lot of average users to wrap their head around. And so what's required is that if you understand this technology and you're prepared to hold on to your private key, then you should. But for everyone else, you need to rely on companies that have better safeguards against wrongdoing and hacking. And that's it's a fascinating question, because a lot of people in the community view blockchain as some kind of great disintermediator. And I view it slightly differently, which is that what blockchain does is enables you to price the value of what an intermediary does. So if an intermediary sits in the middle of a transaction, is just rent seeking and clipping a fee for adding no value, then they'll be disintermediated. But if they're performing a service like providing advice or providing access to credit or enabling you to do something, then the blockchain ought to empower them. And within that group of responsibilities will be safeguarding certain sensitive information, including private keys.
Right. Okay. So this is
Wiley, just, jump in.
Yeah, just to jump in real quick. One point that I wanted to make. So this is why I tend to disagree that this blockchain Bitcoin thing is open, because you have differences in knowledge about what these systems are, which means that some people are not going to be able to interact directly with the protocol, and they're going to have to use these third parties. Also, in terms of Bitcoin, when you look at the public ledger space, there's competitive mining now, which raised, had the ASIC race, and so that put huge barriers on people to enter the market. Not everybody can buy an ASIC and start mining and make any money off that. They're just going to be losing money. So the idea that these are open protocols that anybody can use, I sort of disagree with.
Well, there's a distinction to be made between being open for use and being open for mining. You're absolutely right that
you could still be a node as a say a wallet holder, but you don't have to be a node that's a miner.
Sure.
Again,
you have this, like, the lack of knowledge that some people have, technical capability. So it's like the DAO is another prime example. It's like everybody was supposed to kind of look over the code and make sure that there weren't any flaws in that code. And obviously that didn't happen. And some people, you know, the idea was, well, if you join the DAO, then, you know, you should be capable of reading that code and knowing what you're getting into. But not everybody's capable of that. Who wants to invest in these types of things.
Which implies you need a trusted intermediary to manage these nodes.
Right.
We're called banks.
Right, exactly. So then it's like sort of what's the point, I guess.
I think you're starting to see some intermediaries come up to make this easier. Certainly the issue with the DAO was such that people couldn't differentiate between coding and the profit potential there. And the same thing with mining. They want to get involved with it. So we're seeing intermediaries with mining pools. We're seeing intermediaries who are making the ability to buy Bitcoin a lot easier. So you're going to start to see these intermediaries come into play that are going to make this easier for the typical investor, the typical user, to get their hands on Bitcoin and blockchain assets. And I think that's going to be something we're going to see in the very near future.
And there's a key thing there, which is that the Bitfinex hack, the reason why that was actually quite incredible is that multisig is meant to mean that you don't need any of these intermediaries, and yet multisig was broken in that hack. So there's still a long way to go in developing the infrastructure and the platforms here.
Yeah, so two points from me. Number one, blockchain will disintermediate lots of different players from the industry who don't add value and just are in the industry because of their historical, you know, precedent. But it will also be a very powerful force for re-intermediation. You know, this is creative destruction in action. It happens with every single technology revolution, which is that leaders of the old paradigm fail to adapt or treat the new with hostility or derision, and someone else comes along and finds a new way to use technology to add value. In terms of the what's the point, you know, the fact of the matter is that even with intermediaries who do things like add customer service or ease of use or security, blockchain is still a vastly superior way to move money. And I'll give you a great example. So there's a housekeeper in Toronto. Her name's Annalie Domingo. And for 25 years, she's been sending money home via Western Union. And the process by which she sends this money home is ridiculous. She goes to the bank, deposits a check, withdraws cash, gets on a bus, goes to a supermarket, waits in line for an hour, sends the money. Her 75-year-old grandmother in Manila receives it 5 to 7 days later, and she pays 10%. Well, now Annalie is working with a company called Abra, which you could argue is sort of a re-intermediated company, a new company, that's leveraging the Bitcoin blockchain as a payment rail for moving value between two points. And now Annalie gets her paycheck deposited into her account, ABRA account on her phone. She presses a button. The money appears nearly instantly in her mother's account. The fee that ABRA charges is 0.25%, 25 basis points. And her mom is able to go onto the app and find tellers in the area, usually delivery people or people on motorcycles, meet them halfway and exchange virtual pesos for physical pesos. The whole thing takes a few minutes and costs 1% to 2% versus taking 5 to 7 days and costing 10%.
And arguably, it's exactly how money should work in a digital-based economy, right?
Sure. I mean, think about it. Like, think about it this way. When was the last time you used?
Hey, Alex.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have to go to a short break, dude. So just give me, hold that thought. And then when we come back, I want to talk about this a bit more, trust and the whole Golden 8 thing. So for those of you listening to us, this is Breaking Banks. We're just going to take a very short break. I promise it'll be short because this discussion is very interesting. But just a quick shout out to our sponsors, Temenos, our big sponsor for Breaking Banks, and our series sponsor for the blockchain series, Edge Labs. Check them out on edgelabs.io. We'll be right back with more Breaking Banks in a moment.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, you are back live in New York City with Breaking Banks. We have people from all over the world joining us on the show today. We have Alex Tapscott in Canada. And say hello, Alex.
Hello, hello.
Alex is the author of a brand new best-selling book called Blockchain Revolution, number one in banking and economics on Amazon today. And you've done pretty well. Did you get on the New York Times bestseller list yet, Alex?
Not yet, but I'm hoping this podcast will make a difference.
There you go. Well played. We also have Bailey on. Bailey, you want to give a shout out? Where are you from today? Where are you calling in from?
Yeah, based in Colorado.
Okay, Colorado. And Jack, where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from outside of Princeton, New Jersey, and we've got some thunder and lightning out here. So in case
New Jersey, there you go.
Cool. It's Springsteen country.
And Chris is manning the Breaking Banks desk studio in London.
Of course, that's the reason for the posh accent.
The posh accent. There you go. So let's jump back into talking about blockchain. But before we get to that, Alex, tell me about the process of writing the book. I'm particularly interested in how you negotiated that with your father, working with him on writing. How did you divide your responsibilities up, and how did the process work?
Well, our collaboration together started 2.5 years ago. Well, technically, it started about 30 years ago when I was born. But more recently, about 2.5 years ago, Don was running a multi-million-dollar research project at the University of Toronto, looking at how technology was enabling new forms of global problem solving. And one of the technologies that he wanted to sort of figure out was Bitcoin. And so we turned to the person he knew who had the most knowledge of financial services, which happened to be me. And on a ski trip to Mont-Tremblant, Quebec, we were having dinner and we were talking about his project, and he basically pitched me on writing a paper for him, for his program. And that's how it all got started. This was back in January of 2014. And that paper led to subsequent projects that we launched together through the Robbins School of Business, looking at blockchain's impact on a whole bunch of other things. Around that time, Don's publisher came to him and said,
"Do you call your dad Don?"
Yeah, for like when I'm doing it like this, I talk to him. One-on-one, he's still Dad, but for the sake of your audience, he's Don in this conversation.
Okay, that's cool. I'm just giving.
Yeah. His publisher said, "There's this blockchain thing. It seems really hot. Do you know anything about it?" And Don said, "Are you kidding me? We've been working on this for a year and a half." And so the publisher said, "Well, what do you think of writing a book with your son, Alex?" And so he said, "Well, there's only one way to find out." So he and I together worked on a book proposal, which we took to the publisher, Penguin Random House, which is the largest nonfiction publisher in the world. And they loved it. And they basically gave us an offer we couldn't refuse, as they say. Most books go to auction, but they gave us a deal up front. And so we got on our way. This would have been in January of 2015. So we spent all of last year working on this together. And amazingly, we worked really well together. I think it helps when you share DNA with your writing partner. But we didn't always agree on things. There's an old quote that basically, if two people agree on every single thing, one of them is unnecessary. That was not the case for us in our collaboration. So it was great. I focused on areas where I knew more than he did, like in financial services. He spent 40 years talking about technology's impact on management and on the corporation. So he handled things like the corporation and government. We looked at sort of totally novel things like the music industry, for example, the Internet of Things, which is a fascinating subject, and we've kind of divided and conquered together on the book. And the product of is what we think is a pretty good book. We'd like to think that the reason it's a bestseller is because we wrote a killer book, and I think that might be part of it. But I also think we've really hit the zeitgeist here.
Yeah, it's just the right time, and everyone's excited about it. And
had we written Blockchain Revolution and it was released in May of 2015, I'm not sure there would have been the audience for it, but it happened to come out in May in 2016.
Chris and I have had this conversation probably 20 times on various book titles.
Catching the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, but you guys have done really well. Yeah, you've got a good publicist, no doubt, as well, yeah?
Well, you know, we do have a good publicist, but a lot of this is a lesson for authors if you're listening. Writing the book is 50% of the work. Making the book sell is the other 50%. And Don and I spend a lot of our time making sure that people understand that this book is important and that they ought to read it, regardless of what industry they might be in. I think there's a misconception that it's a financial services technology when, of course, we view it more as a general purpose technology like the Internet that's going to impact everything from business to government to society.
I should say thanks to your dad, by the way, Alex. He gave a great endorsement of my book, so I use it regularly.
I read your book, Chris.
Oh, thanks.
Well done.
He and I read it together. We thought about how best to recommend your book. But anyway, it was a great book.
Well, you guys did well. I do have a tweet from Dave Birch. I don't know whether I should read this out. He says, "Breaking banks. If anyone has a better idea than mine, I had my private key converted to a QR code and tattooed on my scrotum." Please let us know. I don't feel comfortable saying that word on the AM.
I have a much better idea than that, Dave.
What's that?
I mean, no one's ever going to see it. So get it tattooed somewhere where someone can actually read it, for God's sake.
Yeah, I mean, how would he check his own balance on his
absolutely. If he went to the bank and dropped his trousers, I'd get him thrown in jail. So I'm definitely not having mind to do there.
Now I know what he meant when he said identity is the new money.
Yeah. Show me the money.
All right, I've always said that David is full of balls anyway, so he's just proven it.
Hey, so Jack, maybe let's just jump in here for a minute. You know, we have a lot of people that started off in the Bitcoin space where you've been involved in, where they're real purists. They're almost anarchists in respect to this issue of centralization. But how do we focus on, you know, creating that trust that is necessary, but also the revolutionary component of disruption of this?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the point about timing, because we wrote the book, What's the Deal with Bitcoins, back in 2013, when about the only place you could get Bitcoin was through Mt. Gox, and we all know how that worked out. But what was interesting is we got involved in understanding the blockchain infrastructure from that, and that led me to get involved with a company that at the time was a startup called Factum, which I know Alex has mentioned in his book, and we actually were one of the first books to be entered into the blockchain, and we worked with Factum, and we also worked with some other developers to get the book registered on the blockchain. And the thinking there was to trademark it and use copyright. And then we started to realize that this is really revolutionary in terms of how this can change things, normal governance types of things like trademarks and licensing and smart contracts. And obviously we've seen that, and I'm going back a few years. I think what's very interesting too, when you draw this comparison between Bitcoin and blockchain, a number of years ago, just about 2 years ago, I remember going to a Bitcoin conference at the Jacob Javits Center here in New York, and it was a very small, sparse audience. And there was a lot of feeling that Bitcoin was really dying at that time. And then this past year, I went to a blockchain conference in New York, totally sold out, couldn't get in there. I mean, we had major people, government officials. And one of the big differences I commented to someone was that at the blockchain conference, there were all these suits and all these ties that we didn't see at the Bitcoin conference. And suddenly this had become business. This had become the blockchain revolution, and businesses were trying to understand how to harness this. And I think from the perspective of people who came from the Bitcoin world and are now looking at this revolution in the blockchain area, there's a bit of a concern that obviously the blockchain is revolutionary and distributed ledgers are going to make a major impact, but there still needs to be that reward system in place, which is Bitcoin, and there needs to be that ability to have a decentralized network to it. So suddenly when you see all these banks embracing blockchain, there's a fear that centralization could come back somehow. If there's too much control by the banks and the financial service industries, can it ultimately be decentralized? And what will be the reward system that will make sure that everyone's playing ball together? So I think there's a real fear for those people who are following the digital currencies and what they're seeing in the blockchain world to really want to see the revolutionary impact of the blockchain happen, rather than it just being another database tool that the banks end up using, which I have a fear that they could be using, they could be doing here with some of the efforts that they're going forward with.
Just out of interest, Jack, in what you've described, do you think we'll eventually end up, rather than a decentralized ledger, it'll be more like a federated structure?
Well, I think there's going to be a need. Alex made a very good point about governance there and putting that trust in there, the control and the ability to basically feel comfortable with this. So it could very well be that type of thing, because there's going to have to be a certain element of governance, but the governance cannot be controlling. It cannot create a world where we have collusions between people who have their own agendas, because I think that's not going to take the blockchain to its ultimate point where it's going to need to go. So it's an interesting thing. It's going to be interesting to see where this goes, but I am a bit concerned that a number of these companies and these banks and financial service firms that are jumping on the blockchain, are they really doing it to harness the revolution, or are they trying to figure out a way to save some costs? And ultimately, who's going to benefit? Will it be the banks? Will it be the consumers?
Yeah, I think that's to Alex's great point.
Yeah, I'll just jump in there quickly. Yeah. It goes down to this this dichotomy that basically goes like this: Bitcoin bad, blockchain good. And that's the mantra that a lot of big firms have been operating with. And to Jack's point, it misses the it misses a critical function here, which is that if you love blockchain, then you ought to love Bitcoin, because it's the biggest, most secure, most distributed blockchain, and it's the one that's most widely used. And I do think that there's a real risk that this technology gets captured by the very same powerful forces that captured the internet. You know, the internet is control and profitability is shared asymmetrically amongst a number of large companies and used for very bad reasons by governments in Iran and North Korea and other places. So there's nothing to guarantee that blockchain won't also be captured by those same forces, and that the revolutionary potential of it, its democratizing effect on access to financial services or its ability to ensure people have greater privacy from government, et cetera, might be unrequited. And there's nothing, you know, technology is not a panacea. It doesn't create prosperity. People create prosperity, but people can also do things that are bad. So the point is, and it's to this governance question, how do we ensure that this ecosystem develops in as positive a way as possible? Now, that's not to denigrate or to vilify the people who are building these private federated blockchains. I think it's an important part of the whole ecosystem. And quite frankly, I treat it all as R&D in a very early stage part of the technology, the technology's development. So all of these different stakeholders, big corporations, IBM with Hyperledger, Microsoft with Azure that's working off Ethereum and others, the big banks who've got R3, governments that are testing central bank cryptocurrencies like Canada and the United Kingdom, all of them are part and parcel of the same ecosystem, and they're all going to have a role to play in its governance.
All right, yeah, so
I think it's interesting, though, because I see some of these same like centralization pushes in the Bitcoin space as well, so the centralization of mining. And in my mind, we don't focus enough on building systems that don't have the inherent flaws of our current system. So there's the same inequality. And if we want a better future, we need to be cognizant to build those systems that are a little more equitable. So, you know, again, this kind of goes back to the competitive mining. When you have that, it doesn't allow everyone to play, especially if there's like this ASIC race. But, you know, I love the idea of this mass collaboration that I think Bitcoin has sort of brought about when it comes to value on the internet. But I don't know that I specifically see it. And then there's also a part of that that the people in the companies have to want to collaborate. And when you're talking about finance or these tech oligopolies, there isn't much incentive to collaborate sometimes.
So I do have an update from Dave Birch. He said he's checking his balance right now.
Oh, gross.
He's checking or he's scratching his balance. I'm not sure.
Who's the audience for this show? This is like Howard Stern.
Yeah.
Who's your next guest, Donald Trump?
It's the British influence, Alex. We're bringing over our dirge to the US.
We would never have Trump on this show. I'm sorry. It's probably... I've lost half of the audience in New Jersey.
I was
going
to say Trump in Britain means something completely different anyway. It's to do with flatulence, but there we go.
All right. Dave did have a real question, though, which is what's in the blocks in the trade finance blockchain? Who wants to tackle that?
I mean, well, from the trials that I've seen, and again, these are trials, experiments, proofs of concept, what they're saying is that the flaw in the current system is that basically you've just got the borrower saying, I'm good for the goods, you know, this is what I'm shipping. And in the case of the fraud that I mentioned earlier, that, you know, the Chinese company went to several banks saying that I've got this metal stockpile and got the loans on multiple occasions, because each bank could see that he had the metal, but he didn't say that he had gone to several banks with that metal. So the idea on the blocks of the trade finance blockchain proofs of concept is that every transaction is recorded between the ledger's participants and is visible. So you can just record your goods once on that ledger. You can't say you've financed them on multiple occasions amongst multiple constituencies, because people can see it's recorded on the ledger, and once recorded you can't erase it. So that's the idea. Whether that will work remains to be seen.
So what about What about the potential for revolutionizing identity and privacy? And, you know, what are some of the other applications that are really exciting on top of the blockchain that aren't payments or financial services related?
Well, I think identity is one that's huge. And it points to this incredible phenomenon from the first generation of the internet, which is that the most important asset class that's been created through the digital economy so far is data. You know, in the same way that industrial plant and equipment was the most important asset class in the industrial age and land in the agrarian age. But we all create it, and by we I mean just regular people. But we don't own it. It's owned by Facebook, it's owned by Google, it's owned by Uber, it's owned by your bank, it's owned by your government. And so there's a virtual you out there. There's a virtual you that probably knows you better than you know you. You know, you don't know what exactly you bought, where exactly you went, what exactly you said on social media, but the virtual you does. And that's a problem. It's a problem for a couple reasons. Number one, not having as much access to that data and that information prevents us from using it to either monetize or to manage our affairs. But more importantly is the privacy question. You know, it makes the assumption that corporations and governments are always acting in your best interest. And history has proven time and again that that's not necessarily the case. So what if the virtual you was owned by you, where you had an identity that had different slivers of it, essentially? There's you, the citizen. There's you, the employee of a corporation. There's you, the user of social media. There's you, the customer of the bank, etc. And you only need to divulge the information that's absolutely critical to receiving whatever it is you want to receive. So, for example, it's not necessary, really, that a merchant knows your identity. If you go to a hot dog stand and buy a hot dog, the guy doesn't ask you for your driver's license. He just wants to make sure that he's getting paid. And the same can apply in a lot of different areas. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities for companies. In fact, I think this could be an opportunity for them to build better relationships with their customers. Imagine in the case of, say, a life insurance company, they really want to know whether or not you're living a healthy, active lifestyle. And right now, they don't really have the tools to do that. Well, what if you could provide information, say, from your Fitbit or from a sensor in your running shoe about how often you're running or what you're doing? That information
was recorded. Or your heart rate from a smartwatch.
Or your heart rate from a smartwatch. That was recorded on a blockchain where everyone could trust that that information was valid, but that the insurance company couldn't see unless you allowed them to see it. And if for allowing them to see it, you might receive, I don't know, lower premiums on your insurance, a rebate, different products, etc. The insurance company likes it because they've got more information to make actuarial calculations. You like it because you're paying less cost. That's a virtuous circle where both parties are benefiting. But the key point here is that it's the person who is deciding how their data gets used, not the big data aggregator.
All right, well, we've got time for about one more question, Chris, so...
Well, I was going to say, I know we're moving towards a close, but I just wanted to hear back from Jack. And I know, Jack, that you've been looking at how to use blockchain for growing assets. Can you just touch on a little bit around that subject for us?
Sure. And I know we've got some short time here, but I think one of the very interesting things that we're seeing around the blockchain revolution has been the way that we're seeing new companies being funded. And we're seeing this amazing growth in new coins. You know, we talk about Bitcoin, but the reality is, you know, we also have Ethereum. But if you take a look at the exchanges out there, the blossoming of blockchain assets is just, it's amazing how many there are out there. And I almost view it as, we've talked about how blockchain is the new internet. This is almost the new internet. We're seeing companies that are being funded and are growing because they're selling coins. And so the growth of the blockchain assets and the ability to fund new companies using coins is an amazing thing that is also an outgrowth of this whole blockchain revolution.
Hey, so Bailey, just quickly, you know, you're doing a lot of writing on this, and you've written on the DAO and Ethereum. You know, can you talk just quickly about consensus and how we can achieve better consensus among the blockchain community?
Yeah, I mean, well, so in my mind, the biggest issue with some of these projects is, which hopefully I'm answering your question, but one of the biggest issues I kind of see is that the community is just not very diversified. So there are groups that are trying to diversify that community. Be Safe is one of them, trying to get in a bunch of academics to work on projects and test the protocols. But otherwise, it's still like a very small group of people that tend to be technologists that all sort of think and act the same. And I think that's going to be a struggle when you want to bring these protocols or these products and services to the mass market.
So maybe we can get some of that through the consensus or consortium blockchains because of the nature of the different people involved. So, hey, just quickly before we finish up, guys, let's just go around the table and, where can people find your book, Alex?
My book is available everywhere books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores. But, of course, the best way to buy the book is in massive volume.
Good one. All right. And where can they follow you on Twitter? What's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is at Alex Tapscott. I post oftentimes, many times a day. You can check me out on Facebook. You can check out my website, npvinc.com, to learn more about my business as well.
Great. And Bailey, how can people follow your ramblings?
Yeah. Thank you for calling it ramblings. I do that too. Yeah. So I'm just at BLR13 on Twitter. And then my blog is moneytripping.com. And then obviously I write for CoinDesk and American Banker and all those other pubs.
Very cool. And so, that's very cool. And Jack?
You can catch me on Twitter at Safe4Retirement, the number 4. And my book, What's the Deal with Bitcoins, is on Amazon. And then also I write for about.com on the Bitcoin Expert there, and I also write for Bitcoinist.net.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Chris, for joining us and helping out with the show. And thank you for listening to Breaking Banks, especially to our friend Dave Birch, who is listening in out in London. The Breaking Down the Blockchain series is sponsored by our friends at Edge Labs. Check them out at edgelabs.io. And if you like the show, my producer, Rachel, begs you to go to iTunes and give us a review. Thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks, guys. That's the show for this week. We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Yep.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for more of the latest in fintech news.